following days, the way a graduate student might pick apart a Shakespeare sonnet. "Maybe we can get a drink afterward," I said, and my own voice in my head sounded relatively calm.
"Sure," she said.
It was a November night, dark by the time we were diagonally crossing Copley Square to get to the library, and the park was littered with brittle leaves. We sat toward the back of the small auditorium. Ruth Rendell was interviewed by a local radio personality who was far too interested in himself. Still, it was an interesting conversation, and afterward, Claire and I walked to the poorhouse for a drink, sitting in a corner booth until closing time. We talked about books, of course, and the other employees at the bookstore. Nothing personal. But when we were standing in front of her apartment building in Alston at 2 in the morning, the wind causing us both to shiver, she said before we'd even kissed,
"I'm a bad idea."
"What do you mean?" I laughed.
"I mean, whatever ideas you're having about me are bad ones. I've got issues."
"I don't care," I said.
"Okay," she said,
and I followed her inside. I'd had 2 girlfriends in college, one of whom was a German exchange student studying for a year in Amherst, and the other a freshman when I was a senior, a girl from Holton, Maine, who joined the literary magazine that I was then editing. I had roughly the same feelings toward both of them. What drew me to them was the fact that they were drawn to me. Both were nervous talkers, and since I tended on the quiet side, it had worked out. When Petra returned to Germany, I told her that I'd be visiting her as soon as possible. Her response, that she never expected our relationship to last beyond her time in America, was both confusing and somehow an enormous relief. I had been under the impression that she was in love with me. 2 years later, when I'd graduated, I'd told Ruth Porter, my freshman girlfriend, that now that I was moving to Boston and she was staying in Amherst, we should end the relationship. I'd expected a happy indifference on her part, but she looked as though I'd shot her in the stomach. Through a series of wrenching conversations, I did finally manage to break up with her, realizing that I'd also broken her heart. I decided then that I was not good at reading women, or maybe just people in general. So when I stepped into Claire Mallory's apartment, and when we began to kiss before we'd even gotten our jackets off, I told her, "Just so you know, I think I'm terrible at nonverbal cues. I need you to tell me everything." She laughed.
"Are you sure?"
"Yes, please," I said. And it was all I could do to not tell her I was already in love with her.
"Okay, I'll tell you everything."
She started that night. In bed with the dawn light filling her 2 dusty bedroom windows, she told me how her middle school science teacher had molested her over the course of 2 years. "You didn't tell anyone?" I said.
"No,"
she said.
"It's a cliche, but I was ashamed.
I thought it was my fault, and I kept telling myself that he wasn't having sex with me, at least. We'd never even kiss. In fact, he was nice to me, in a way, both him and his wife. But when he got me alone, he'd always manage to somehow get behind me, pull me in for a hug, put one hand in my shirt and the other down my jeans. I think he used to come that way. But he never took my clothes off, or his, and afterward he'd always look a little sheepish, say something like, 'That was nice,' and then he'd change the subject."
"Jesus," I'd said.
"It wasn't a huge deal," she said. "Other shitty things have happened to me, and that was just one of them. I sometimes think my mom fucked me up even more than my molester did." She had tattoos on the insides of her arms and along either side of her ribcage. Just straight lines, dark and thin. I asked her about them, and she told me she loved the feeling of getting a tattoo but could never pick any image that she'd want on her body forever. So she just got lines, one at a time. I thought they were beautiful, just as I thought her body, unhealthily thin, probably, was also beautiful. I think our relationship worked so well for a time because I never judged her, never questioned what she told me. I knew she had issues, that she drank too much, although she hadn't taken drugs in close to a year, and that she ate too little, and that sometimes when we had sex, I could feel her wanting me to objectify her, that it wasn't always enough to have normal, loving sex, that she wanted more. When she was drunk, she'd turn her back to me, pull my hands around to her front, grind herself up against me, and it was impossible for me to not think of her teacher in middle school and wonder if she was thinking of him as well. But all this darkness, if that's what it's even called, was only part of what we had for the first 3 years we were together. Most of what we had was an incredible closeness, the happiness that comes with finding someone who seems to fit inside of you like a key in a lock. That's the best metaphor I can come up with. I know it's trite, but it's also true. And it was the only time that this type of connection ever happened with me, then or since. We got married in Las Vegas, our witness, a blackjack dealer we'd met 5 minutes earlier. The major reason we eloped was because Claire could not deal with the prospect of her mother hijacking her own wedding. It was fine with me. My own mother had died 3 years prior from lung cancer. She'd never smoked a day in her life, but my father, the chain smoker, was still alive, of course, now living in Fort Myers, Florida, and still, as far as I knew, an alcoholic and a 3-packs-a-day Winston man. After Claire and I were married, we moved to Somerville together, rented the middle floor of a triple-decker near Union Square. Claire had left Redline Bookstore by this point, getting an administrative job at Somerville's cable access station, where she had begun to make short documentary films. And a year later, after Redline shuttered its doors, I got the job at Old Devils. I was 29 years old and felt as though I'd found the job that I would have for the rest of my life. It wasn't so easy for Claire. She hated her job at the cable station, but she didn't have a college degree and every position she was interested in required one. She decided to go back to school part-time at Emerson College and finish an undergraduate degree. And she got work as a bartender at a divey club in Central Square. I used to visit her there, sitting long hours at the bar, suffering through over-amplified punk bands, drinking Guinness, and watching my wife get ogled by hipsters in dark-rimmed glasses and skinny jeans. I developed the ability to read entire novels while ignoring the thunderous amateurs on stage. Even though I wasn't older than the other patrons of the bar, I felt older, what with my book and my graying hair. The other bartenders referred to me as Claire's old man, and Claire started calling me old man as well. I think that, for a time, my wife loved my presence at her bar. At the end of her shift, she'd join me in having a beer, and then we'd walk back home together, arm in arm, through the dark, cluttered streets of Cambridge and Somerville. But something changed in 2007. Claire's sister Julie was getting married, and Claire was suddenly embroiled back with her family, recruited in to serve as a buffer between her youngest sister and her mother. She lost the weight she'd gained over the last few years and added several new tattooed lines to the inside of her left thigh. Also, she fell in love with a new bartender named Patrick Yates. Chapter 9. After my bad dinner, I got into bed early with my Penguin edition of The Murder of Roger Ackroyd, but I couldn't concentrate. I kept rereading the first page, my mind skipping around between thoughts of my wife and wondering who had written the comment on my blog post. I filled my lungs with the stale air of my apartment, then slowly exhaled. Why did he call himself Dr. Shepherd? Because he was the killer, right? Still, that didn't mean I needed to try and read the book. I put it on my nightstand where I kept a stack of poetry collections. That's what I read at night now, before I go to sleep. Even if I'm currently into a literary biography, even though I rarely read crime, I do read biographies of crime writers. Or something on European history. The last words I read before I try to fall asleep are the words of poets. All poems, all works of art, really, seem like cries of help to me, but especially poetry. when they are good, and I do believe there are very few good poems, reading them is like having a long-dead stranger whisper in your ear, trying to be heard. I got out of bed and went to my bookshelf to find an anthology of poems that contained one of my favorites, Winter Nightfall by Sir John Squire. I could probably recite it by heart, but I wanted to see the words. When I found a poem I loved, I would read it again and again. For one entire year, I must have read Sylvia Plath's Black Rook in Rainy Weather every night before I fell asleep. Lately, I'd been reading Peter Porter's An Exequy, even though I understood less than half of it. I do not have a critical mind for poems, but I react to them. Back in bed, I read the Squire poem, then shut my eyes and let the final words gallop over me, and the slop of my footsteps in this desolate country's cadaverous clay, again and again, like a mantra. I thought some more of my wife and the decisions that I made. When Patrick Yates came into her life, and I actually remember the date because it was March 31st, my birthday, I knew right away that something momentous had occurred. Claire had done the afternoon shift that day at the bar, so as to get out early and take me to the East Coast Grill for my birthday dinner. "We finally hired a new bartender," she said. "Oh, Patrick. I started training him today. He seems okay." The way she said his name, a combination of hesitancy and boldness, and I knew right away that he had made an impression on her. My body felt as though an almost imperceptible electric current had coursed through it. "Does he have experience?" I asked as I tipped an oyster back. "He worked at a pub in Australia for a year, so that's something. I thought of you because he has a tattoo of Edgar Allan Poe on his right shoulder." I was not a jealous husband, but I was also aware that Claire, unlike myself, was never going to go through life content with just me. She'd been with numerous men in college, and she'd admitted more than once that she'd go through periods when every time she met a man, or every time she'd pass a man on the street, she'd wonder if that man wanted her, and then she'd obsess over what these men might think about doing to her. I'd listen to these confessions and tell myself that it was better that she told me, better than the alternative, better than secrets. She did have a therapist, a woman she referred to as Dr. Martha, whom she saw once every 2 weeks, but after her appointments she'd be in a dark mood, sometimes for days, and I wondered if it was worth it. Part of me had always told myself that one day Claire would cheat, or maybe not cheat, but that she would fall for someone else. And I'd accepted that. And hearing about Patrick, I knew that day had come. It scared me, but I had already decided what to do. Claire was my wife. She would always be my wife, and I would stand by her no matter what. It provided a sense of comfort, knowing that I was in it for the long haul, no matter what. She did have an affair with Patrick, at least an emotional one, although I suspect it tipped over into the physical on at least a couple of occasions. I waited patiently, like the wife of a sea captain, hoping that she'd make it alive through the storm. I wonder sometimes if I should have fought more, threatened to leave, berated her when she came home 2 hours after the bar had closed, her clothes smelling of the American spirits that he smoked, her breath sharp with gin. But I didn't. That wasn't my choice. I waited for her to come back to me, and one night, a hot summer night in August, she did. I had just arrived home from the bookstore, and she was sitting on our sofa, head bowed, tears in her eyes. "I've been such an asshole," she said. "A little bit." "Will you ever forgive me?" "I will always forgive you," I said. Later that night, she asked me if I wanted details, and I said only if she needed to say them out loud. "God, no," she said. "I'm done with it." I found out later, but not from Claire, that Patrick Yates had disappeared after cleaning out the till on a Saturday night, and that at least 3 other female bartenders at the club had all been devastated by his departure.
After that incident, it got better between Claire and me, although things were worse with her. She quit the club and dropped out of Emerson College. For a while, she did a few shifts at Old Devil's, but then she got another job as a bartender at an upscale restaurant in the Back Bay. The money was good, but she felt frustrated with the lack of creativity in her life. "I don't want to be a bartender for the rest of my life. I want to make films, but I need to go to school to do that."
"You don't have to go to school," I said. "You could just make a film."
And that's what she did.
There were her evening shifts at the restaurant, and during the daytime, she made short documentary films. One about tattoo artists, one about the polyamory community in Davis Square, even one about the Old Devil's bookstore. She posted them on YouTube, and that was where Eric Atwell found her. Atwell ran what he called an innovation incubator outside of Boston in a renovated farmhouse in Southwell. He offered free workspace and occasional bedrooms to young creatives in return for a percentage of their final product's profits. He contacted Claire, told her he liked her tattoo documentary, and asked if she'd film a promotional video for his incubator. Unlike with Patrick Yates, I didn't get a bad feeling about Eric Atwell when Claire first started telling me about him. She said he was a cliché, a 50-year-old who acted 30, someone who clearly liked to surround himself with young people, preferably sycophants.
"Sounds like a creep," I said. "I don't know. More like a con man. I think he's just really hoping to stumble into the next big thing and make a quick buck." She spent a weekend at the farmhouse. The name of his company was Black Barn Enterprises. And when she returned, I sensed that something had changed in her. She was jumpy, a little irritated, but also somewhat more affectionate with me. A few days after the weekend, Claire woke me up in the middle of the night and asked me, "Why do you love me?"
"I don't know," I said. "I just do."
"You must have reasons."
"If I had reasons to love you, then there'd be reasons for me not to love you."
"What do you mean?"
"I don't know. I'm tired."
"No, tell me. I'm curious."
"Okay. So if I loved you because you're beautiful, then that would mean I wouldn't love you anymore if you had some kind of accident that disfigured your face."
"Or simply grew old."
"Right, or grew old. And if I loved you because you're a good person, then that would mean I would stop loving you if you did something bad. And that wouldn't happen."
"You're way too good for me," she said, but she laughed.
"What do you love about me?" I said.
"Your youthful good looks," she said, laughing some more. "Actually, I love you because you're an old soul in a young man."
"And one day I'll be an old soul in an old man."
"I can't wait," she said.
Because I worked mostly during the daytime and she tended to work night shifts at the restaurant, it took me a while to find out that she had kept going back out to Southwell during the daytime hours. I started keeping track of the mileage on her Subaru. I felt bad spying in that way, but my suspicions turned out to be correct. It was clear that she was going out to Southwell 2 or 3 times a week. I assumed she was having an affair either with Atwell or maybe with one of Atwell's tenants. It didn't occur to me, at least not in those first few weeks, that she'd been going to Black Barn Enterprises for another reason, until I realized that the normally skin-tight jeans she wore to work were beginning to look baggy around her waist. I found her cocaine, plus a small pill box filled with an assortment of pills, in one of the compartments of the jewelry box she'd inherited from her grandmother. Later, after I'd confronted her, she told me how that first weekend at Black Barn, Atwell had thrown a dinner party with a ton of great wine. When she told him she was ready for bed, he'd talked her into a small amount of coke just to keep the party going. The next day, after she'd finished getting footage for her film, he'd thanked her by giving her a bottle of the Sancerre they'd been drinking the night before, plus a half gram of the cocaine. He'd also explained to Claire that he had devised a system for his drug use, spreading it out so as to not get addicted.
He convinced her it was okay, so long as you followed his scientific schedule. If I'd initially known that Claire's trips out to Southwell were for drugs and not for sex, I might have tried to intervene sooner. As it was, by the time I was hearing about it, Claire was a full-blown addict again. I decided to do what I always did. I decided to wait it out in hopes that she would eventually agree to quit or to go to rehab. I know how it sounds. I know that maybe if I'd done something, given her an ultimatum, contacted her parents, gotten her friends involved, anything, that maybe the outcome would have been different. I still think about this all the time. When I was a teenager, I remember asking my mom why she put up with my father's drinking. She'd frowned, not because she was upset, but because she was confused. "What choice do I have?" she'd finally said. "You could leave him," she shook her head. "I'd rather wait for him." "Even if you have to wait forever?" I said. She nodded in response. That was how I felt about Claire during those moments when she wasn't fully mine. I was waiting for her. When the two uniformed officers knocked on my apartment door early on the first day of 2010, I knew that she was dead before either of them spoke. "Okay," I remember saying after they'd delivered the news that she'd been in a car accident at 3 in the morning and that she'd been killed instantly. "Was anyone else hurt?" I asked. "No, she was alone, and no other vehicles were involved in the accident." "Okay," I said again, and went to shut the door, figuring that the police were done with me. But they stopped me from closing the door, explained that I needed to come down to the station for identification purposes. 3 months later, I found a journal she'd been keeping. It was hidden behind a number of larger hardcovers in the section of our bookshelf that she had claimed for herself. I almost burned it without reading it, but curiosity got the better of me, and one wet spring evening, I bought myself a 6-pack of Newcastle Brown, settled in, and read the entire contents. Chapter 10. Even though I don't read contemporary mysteries anymore, I keep up with the trends. I am well aware that Gone Girl by Gillian Flynn has changed the industry, that unreliable narrators are suddenly popular, along with domestic suspense, with books that posit the question of whether we can really trust anyone, especially the ones closest to us. Some of the reviews I read make it sound as though this is a recent phenomenon, as though the idea of discovering a spouse's secrets constituted something new, or that the omission of facts from a narrative hadn't been the bedrock upon which psychological thrillers have been built for over a century. The narrator of Rebecca, a novel published in 1938, never even gave the readers her name. The thing is, and maybe I'm biased by all those years I've spent in fictional realms built on deceit, I don't trust narrators any more than I trust the actual people in my life. We never get the whole truth. Not from anybody. When we first meet someone, before words are ever spoken, there are already lies and half-truths. The clothes we wear cover the truth of our bodies, but they also present who we want to be to the world. They are fabrications, figuratively and literally. So I wasn't surprised when I found my wife's secret journal, and I wasn't surprised that there were things inside it that she'd never told me. Many things. For the purposes of this story, of my story, I won't go into everything that I discovered from reading the journal. She didn't want the world to know, and I don't either. But I do need to record what happened between Claire and Eric Atwell. Not surprisingly, they had been sexually involved. It wasn't a romantic liaison. Claire had become addicted to cocaine, and after a time during which Atwell had been furnishing it free of charge, he began to ask for money. She and I had shared one bank account together, for rent, for household expenses, for vacations. But we each had separate accounts as well, and hers had been emptied in about the space of 3 weeks. After that, she had paid Atwell in sexual favors. It was his idea.
Without going into detail, some of what he asked her to do was truly demeaning. At one point, she told him about her bad experience with Mr. Clifton, the middle school teacher. "I could see the excitement in his eyes," she wrote. I read the rest of the journal. Then, the following weekend, I drove out to Walden Pond in Concord, passing through Southwell. The lot was nearly empty. It was 10 degrees outside, the pond frozen, the skies above a chalky white. I walked along a trail that climbed a ridge above the pond, then doused the journal in kerosene and burned it in a clearing, stomping on the remains until the book was nothing more than a crater of black soot in the snow and ashes in the air. I never regretted destroying Claire's journal, although sometimes to this day I regret having read it. When I moved from our apartment in Somerville to the studio in Beacon Hill, I got rid of everything else that remained of Claire. Her clothes, the furniture she'd bought for our place, her school yearbooks. I kept a few of her books, her childhood copy of A Wrinkle in Time, an annotated paperback of Anne Sexton's collected poetry that she'd bought for a class during her freshman year at Boston University. That book is on my bedside table, always. Sometimes I read the poems inside, but mostly I look at Claire's notes and doodles, the lines and the words she'd underlined. Sometimes I touch the indentations that her ballpoint pen made on the page. Mostly, these days, I just like that the book is there, within easy reach. It's been 5 years since she died, but I talk to her more now in my head than I did immediately after she died. I talked to her the night I got into bed with Agatha Christie's The Murder of Roger Ackroyd, told her all about the list and the visit from Agent Mulvey, and what it felt like to be reading these books again. I woke around 8:30 in the morning, surprised that I'd gotten any sleep at all. I'd forgotten to pull the curtains in my apartment, and bright, hard sunlight was flooding in. At the window, I looked outside toward the irregular roofline across the street, now covered with snow, icicles decorating the gutters. There were spidery lines of frost on the outside of the windows, and the street below had the grayish pallor that meant it was incredibly cold outside. I checked my phone, and it was currently registering 1 degree above zero. I almost considered sending emails to Emily and Brandon, letting them know that they could take the day off, that it was too cold to ask them to come in, but changed my mind. I bundled up and walked down to Charles Street, to a cafe that served oatmeal. I was at a corner table reading a copy of yesterday's Globe that had been sitting on the table when my cell phone rang.
"Malcolm, it's Gwen."
"Hi," I said.
"Were you sleeping?"
"Oh, no, I'm getting breakfast. I'm about to go into the store. Are you still in Boston?"
"No, I got home yesterday afternoon and all the books I'd ordered had arrived, so last night I read Strangers on a Train."
"Yeah, and?"
"I'd love to talk with you about it. Is there a good time?"
"Can I call you back when I get to the store?" I said. My oatmeal had just arrived, steam pouring from the bowl.
"Sure," she said. "Call me back."
After finishing breakfast, I went to Old Devil's. Emily was already there, and Nero had been fed. "You're here early," I said.
"Remember that I'm leaving early."
"Oh, right," I said, although I hadn't remembered that.
"Mr. Popovich complained again," she said, rubbing her hands together. "He wants to return his last shipment."
"The whole shipment?"
"Yep. He says they were all improperly graded."
David Popovich was a collector who lived in New Mexico, but all of us at the bookstore felt like he might as well live next door. He bought a ton of books from us and returned half of them at least. He occasionally called to complain, but mostly he sent us snide emails. "Cut him off," I said.
"What?"
"Write him back and tell him that we'll accept whatever returns he has, but that he can't order through us anymore. I'm done with him."
"You serious?"
"Yes. Would you rather I write the email?"
"No, I'm happy to do it. Should I CC you?"
"Sure," I said. Banishing Popovich would probably hurt our bottom line in the end, but for the moment, I didn't care. And it felt good. Before calling Gwen back, I sent an email to a publicist at Random House that I'd been ignoring and confirmed a date for her author to come and give a reading in March. Then I opened up the glass case and got our first edition copy of Strangers on a Train, bringing it back with me to the phone. Its cover was deep blue, garishly illustrated with a close-up of a man's face and a sickly-looking woman with red hair. Gwen picked up after one ring. "Hi, Gwen," I said, and her first name sounded strange coming out of my mouth.
"Thanks for calling me back. So, this book."
"What did you think?"
"Bleak. I knew the story because of the movie, but the book was different. Darker, I thought. And do both the men commit murders in the movie?"
I tried to remember. "I don't think so," I said. "No, definitely not. I think the main character in the movie, the tennis player, almost kills the father but doesn't. That probably had a lot more to do with the production code than with what Hitchcock actually wanted to do. I don't think they were allowed to have characters get away with murder." I hadn't read the book in many years or seen the movie again, but I remembered both of them pretty well.
"The Hays Code," she said. "If only it was that way in real life."
"Right.
And he's not a tennis player in the book."
"Who?"
"Guy, the main character. He's an architect."
"Oh, right," I said. "Was reading the book helpful?"
"You mentioned in your list that you thought it was the very best example of a perfect murder," she said, ignoring my question. "What exactly did you mean?"
"It's a perfect crime," I said, "because when you swap murders with someone else, a stranger, basically, then there is no connection between the murderer and their victim. That's what makes it foolproof."
"That's what I've been thinking about," she said. "What's clever about the murder in the book," she continued, "is that the person committing it can't be connected to the crime. It has nothing to do with the method."
"What do you mean?" I said.
"Bruno kills Guy's wife at an amusement park. He strangles her to death. But there's nothing clever about that. I've been thinking about Charlie's rules again. So, if you were Charlie, just humor me, then how would you commit a murder based on Strangers on a Train?"
"I see what you mean. It would be very hard."
"Right. You could just go strangle someone at an amusement park, but that wouldn't be following the philosophy of the crime."
"He'd have to find someone else to commit a murder with him."
"That's what I thought, but not necessarily, really," she said. "If I were Charlie, if I were trying to copy Strangers on a Train, then I would select as a victim someone who is already likely to be murdered. My mind is going blank right now, but suppose someone just went through a bitter divorce, or..."
"Who's the guy in New York who stole everyone's money?" I said.
"Bernie Madoff?"
"Right, him."
"He'd work, but there are maybe too many people who want him dead." "I would pick one half of a bad divorce, I think. Something slightly public. Then I would wait until the spurned spouse was away and I would commit the murder. I think that would be the best way to honor the book."
"That makes sense," I said.
"I think so too. Worth looking into. How about you? Did you have any new thoughts last night?"
"I was pretty tired last night after staying up the night before, so no, but I'll keep thinking about it."
"Thanks," she said. "You've been helpful."
Then she added in a slightly different tone of voice,
"Don't forget to send me your flight information for the trip you took to London this past fall."
"I'll do that today," I said. After I hung up, Nero came clicking along the hardwood floor to settle himself down by my legs. I watched him in a slight daze, thinking about the phone conversation I'd just had.
"I did it,"
came Emily's voice, and I turned around. She was coming toward me, a rare grin on her face.
"Did what?" "Sent the email to Popovich. He's going to be in shock."
"You seem very pleased."
"No, I'm... you know how much he drives me crazy."
"It's fine. Honestly, I think he needs us more than we need him. The customer isn't always right, you know." Emily grinned again, then said,
"Are you feeling okay?"
"I'm fine. Why?"
"Oh, nothing. You seem distracted, that's all.
I didn't know if there was anything going on.
It was so out of character for her to express this much interest in me that I realized that I must be acting noticeably different. I think of myself as stoic, as someone who never reveals too much of themselves, and it worried me that that might not be the case.
"Would it be okay if I go for a walk?" I said. "You can cover the store?"
"Sure."
"It'll be a quick walk," I said.
Outside, it was still bitterly cold, but the sun was out, the sky a hard, unforgiving blue. The sidewalks had been cleared, and I walked toward Charles Street, thinking I'd cut up to the public garden. I kept thinking about the conversation with Gwen about Strangers on a Train, a book that I'd worked hard at not thinking about for many years. There were more people in the park than I thought there would be, considering the temperature. A father was wiping snow off one of the Make Way for Ducklings bronze figures so that he could put his toddler on top of it and take a picture. I must have walked past those ducklings 1,000 times, and there was always a parent or a set of parents posing their child for a photograph. In summertime, there was often a line. And I always wondered what the parents got out of it, their insistence to document a particular moment. Not being a parent, I don't really know. It was actually something that Claire and I had never talked about, having children. I had told myself it was up to her, but maybe she'd been waiting for me to broach the subject. I walked around the frozen pond, the wind now spinning dead leaves, and started to make my way back to the store. I was not innocent, even though sometimes I allowed myself the luxury of thinking that I was. And if Gwen Mulvey discovered the truth, then I would have to accept it.
Chapter 11.
I knew that I was going to kill Eric Atwell the moment I'd finished reading Claire's diary. But it took me many more months to work up the courage to admit that to myself. I also knew that when Atwell was dead, I was going to be an immediate suspect. My wife had been coming from his home on the night she died in a car accident. Atwell had even confessed to providing the drugs that were found in her system, and the police, no doubt, had also determined that Claire Kershaw, nay Mallory, had been having an affair with the wealthy owner of Black Barn Enterprises. I thought of hiring someone to kill Atwell, then making sure that I was far away, out of the country, when it happened. But there were so many reasons this wouldn't work. For one, I doubted I had the kind of money it would take to hire a professional hitman. And even if I could scrape it together somehow, it would be obvious to anyone looking at my suddenly depleted bank account. I also had no idea how to go about hiring a killer, nor did I even want to support such a profession. Anyone who killed people for money was not someone I wanted to be involved with. Besides, it would be giving someone far too much power over my own life. So I decided that I couldn't hire a killer. But I did like the idea of being far away when Eric Atwell was killed. A year earlier, sometime in 2009, a young woman had come into Old Devils with a stack of incredibly valuable first editions. They weren't primarily mystery novels, although there had been an 1892 Harper and Brothers edition of The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes that had made me ache with longing. There were about 10 books in all, including two Mark Twain firsts that must have been worth thousands, and the woman, who had stringy hair and scabbed lips, had been carrying the books in a grocery bag. I asked her where she got them.
"Don't you want them?" she said.
"Not if you can't tell me where you got them from."
She'd left the store as quickly as she'd come in. In retrospect, I began to wish I'd simply bought them from her with whatever money was in the register, and then I'd have been able to find the owner. She must have robbed someone's home and returned the books. As it was, I did call the police to report the incident, and they told me they'd keep an eye and an ear out for reports of stolen books. I never heard anything back from them, and I never saw the young woman again. At that time, Old Devils had an employee named Rick Murphy who worked weekend shifts. Rick was a collector, primarily interested in anything horror-related. I told Rick about the woman who'd come in with the rare first editions.
She might try and sell them online, Rick had said. She didn't look like the type who goes online.
Worth checking, though, he said. There's this pretty tasty little site, more of a dark web place, where people sell collectibles under the table.
Rick, who worked in IT at an insurance company during the week, showed me a site called Duckburg. To me, it looked nearly incomprehensible, like message boards from the early internet days. But Rick pulled up a section where rare collectibles were offered for sale. It was all anonymous. We did searches for some of the books that had been brought into the store, but nothing popped up. What else is on here? I said.
Ah, the gentleman is intrigued. A lot of it is just a place to chat anonymously. To tell the truth, this isn't the true dark web, but it's darkish enough.
Rick went to get his gigantic soda, and I quickly bookmarked the page. I thought I might check it out later, but never did. After deciding in late 2010 to kill Eric Atwell, I went to my bookmarks and discovered I still had that link. I spent a few hours one night after closing time exploring the different portals and creating a fake identity, calling myself Bert Kling. Then I logged onto a portal called Swaps that didn't specify exactly what it was for, but primarily seemed to be sexual in nature. 60-year-old man wants to buy you $1,000 in clothes, young and sexy only. Won't mind me accompanying you into changing room. No touching, just looking. But there were also offers such as, looking for cleaning ladies that want to be paid in Oxy. I opened up a dialogue box and wrote, any strangers on a train fans out there? Would love to suggest a mutually beneficial swap. I posted it and logged off. I told myself to wait for 24 hours before getting back on, but only managed about 12. It was a quiet day at the store, and I logged back onto Duckburg under my alias. I'd gotten a response. Big fan of that book. Would love to discuss. Go to private chat? Okay, I responded, clicking the box that made the chat visible to only the two parties involved. 2 hours later, there was a new message. What did you have in mind? I wrote, there's someone who deserves to disappear from the face of the earth. Can't do it myself, though. I somehow couldn't bring myself to actually write the word die. I have the same problem, came back almost immediately. Let's help each other out, okay? Okay. My heart was beating, and my ears had gone warm. Was I being trapped? It was possible, but all I had to give up was Eric Atwell's information, not my own. I decided, after about 5 minutes, that it was worth it. I wrote, Eric Atwell, 255 Elsinore Street, Southwell, Mass., anytime from February 6th through February 12th. I was going to be at an antiquarian booksellers conference in Sarasota, Florida during that week. My ticket was already bought. I watched the screen for what seemed like an hour, but was probably only 10 minutes. Finally, a message appeared. Norman Cheney, 42 Community Road, Tick Hill, New Hampshire, anytime from March 12th through 19th. After that message, another one popped up 30 seconds later. We should never message again. I wrote, agreed. Then I copied down Norman Cheney's address on the back of an old devil's bookmark and logged out. From what I understood of Duckburg's policy, the conversation would now disappear forever. It was a comforting thought, even though I doubted its veracity. Taking a deep breath, I realized that I'd been barely breathing for the past 20 minutes. I stared at the name and address I'd written down and was just about to punch it into the computer when I stopped myself. I needed to be more careful than that. There were other ways to find out about this person. Right now, the name was enough. I was glad, I had to admit, that it was a man I was supposed to kill. And I was very glad that I was going second. Obviously, I would only have to go through my half of the bargain if Eric Atwell died while I was in Sarasota. In February 2011, I attended the conference. I'd never been to Sarasota before, and I fell in love with its old brick downtown. I made a pilgrimage to what had been John D. McDonald's house on Siesta Key, peering through the locked gates at a mid-century modern structure surrounded by lush vegetation. I even attended some presentations and had dinner with one of my few friends in the antiquarian world, Shelley Bingham, who had owned a used bookstore in Harvard Square before retiring to Bradenton, Florida, and selling used books at Anna Maria Island's weekly flea market. We drank martinis at the Gator Club, and after our second, Shelley said, "Now, I was so gutted to hear about Claire last year. How are you doing?" I opened my mouth to speak, but began to cry instead, loudly enough that several heads swiveled toward me. The suddenness and force of the tears was shocking. I stood up and walked to the restroom at the back of the dark bar where I composed myself, then returned to the bar and said, "Sorry about that, Shell."
"No, please. I'm sorry I brought it up. Let's have another drink and talk about the books we're reading."
It was later that night, back alone in my hotel room, that I got onto my laptop and checked out the Boston Globe's online site. The top story was related to an off-season trade the Red Sox had just made, but the second story was about a homicide in Southwell. The name of the victim had not yet been disclosed by the police. I was tempted to sit with my laptop, refreshing the site until Eric Atwell was named as the victim, but I forced myself to try and sleep instead. I opened the window of my hotel room, lay on the bed under a single sheet, and listened to the breeze, plus the occasional truck rumbling by on the nearby highway. Sometime near dawn, I fell asleep, waking up a few hours later, skin damp with sweat, the sheet twisted around my body. I logged back on to the Globe website. The body that had been found had been identified as Eric Atwell, a prominent local entrepreneur and angel investor. After throwing up in the hotel bathroom, I lay back down on the bed and savored, for a moment, the fact that Atwell had gotten what he deserved. By the time I was back in Boston, I'd learned that Eric Atwell had been reported missing on Tuesday night by one of his housemates. He had gone out on one of his daily walks earlier in the day and had never returned. The following morning, the police conducted a search, and Atwell's body was found near a walking bath on conservation land about a mile from his house. He had been shot several times. His wallet had been taken along with an expensive set of headphones and his cell phone. The police were investigating the possibility of a robbery and asking for help from nearby residents. Had anyone seen someone suspicious? Had anyone heard the gunshots? The article went on to mention that Atwell was a renowned philanthropist, someone with a keen interest in the local art scene, who frequently hosted gatherings and fundraisers at his restored farm in Southwell. The article didn't mention drugs or extortion or anything about Atwell's role in the vehicular death of Claire Mallory. For that, I was glad. A week passed, and I had begun to believe that no one had made any connection between me and Atwell. Then, on a Sunday afternoon, nursing a cold, I was surprised by the sound of the door buzzer. Before I even answered it, I was sure it was the police come to take me away. I braced myself. And it was the police. A tall, sorrowful-looking detective named James, but she did not have the look of a police officer preparing to make an arrest. She said she had a few quick questions. I let her in, and she explained to me that she was a Boston police detective following up on some leads on an unsolved homicide in Southwell.
"Did you know Eric Atwell?"
she asked after she'd taken a seat on the edge of the sofa. "I didn't, but my wife knew him, unfortunately."
"Why unfortunately?"
"I'm sure you know this already because it's why you're here. My wife produced a video for Eric Atwell, and after that they became friends. She, Claire, my wife, died in a car accident coming home from his house in Southwell."
"And did you blame Eric Atwell for this accident?"
"I did, partly, at least. I know that my wife started doing drugs again after she met him." The detective nodded slowly.
Did he provide those drugs?
He did. Look, I know where this is going. I hated Eric Atwell, but I didn't have anything to do with his death. The truth is, my wife had on-again, off-again problems with drugs and alcohol. He didn't force her to start taking drugs. He didn't introduce her to them. Ultimately, it was my wife's decision. I forgave him. It took a lot, but after what happened, I did finally make a decision to forgive him.
So how do you feel now that you know he's been murdered?
I stared at the ceiling as though I were thinking. Honestly, I don't really know. I'm telling the truth when I say that I forgave him, but that doesn't mean that I liked him. I'm not sad, and I'm not exactly happy. It is what it is. If I'm honest about it, I think he probably got what was coming to him.
So you think he was murdered by someone from a sense of, out of revenge, maybe?
You mean, do I think he was intentionally murdered, as opposed to just being mugged?
Right, that's what I mean.
The detective was very still, barely moving in the sofa. It occurred to me. Sure, I can't imagine that my wife is the only one he gave drugs to. And she probably wasn't the only one he started charging after she became addicted. He must have done that to other people. As soon as I spoke the words, I realized it was more than I had wanted to tell the detective. There was something about her calm presence that was making me want to talk. She was nodding again, and when she realized that I had stopped speaking, she said,
"Did your wife end up giving a lot of money to Atwell? Money you didn't have?"
My wife and I had separate accounts, so I wasn't aware of it at the time. But yes, she started giving money to Atwell for drugs.
"I'm sorry to have to ask you this, Mr. Kershaw, but as far as you knew, was there any sexual relationship between your wife and Atwell?"
I hesitated. Part of me just wanted to tell this detective everything I had learned from Claire's diary, but I also knew that the more I spoke, the more it became obvious that I had a very serious motive for Atwell's death. I said, "I don't know, to tell the truth. I suspect they might have." Saying the words made my throat start to close a little, as though I were about to cry, and I pressed the heel of my hand against an eye.
"Okay," the detective said.
"She wasn't herself," I said, unable to stop myself. "I mean, because of the drugs." I wiped a tear from my cheek.
"I understand. I'm sorry to come out here and make you go through all this again, Mr. Kershaw. I hate to have to do this, but investigations of this kind are often all about the elimination of possible suspects. Do you remember where you were on the afternoon of February 8th?
I was in Florida, actually, at a conference.
"Oh," Detective James said, almost looking pleased. "What kind of conference was that?"
"Antiquarian booksellers. I run a used bookstore here in Boston."
"Old devils, right. I've been there."
"Really? Are you a mystery fan?"
"Sometimes," the detective said, and fully smiled for the first time since she'd stepped inside of my apartment. "I went to see Sarah Paretsky Reed about a year ago."
"That sounds right," I said. "She was good, I thought."
"She was. Were you the one who introduced her?"
"I was. You'll be forgiven if you don't remember me. Public speaking is not my forte."
"I think I remember you being fine," she said.
"Thank you for that," I said. Detective James put her hands on her knees and said,
"Unless you have anything to add, I think we're probably done here."
"I don't," I said, and we stood up at the same time. She was almost exactly my height.
"I will need some corroboration about the conference in Florida," she said.
I promised to send her flight details, and I also gave her Shelley Bingham's name and address. The detective left a card. Her first name was Roberta. Chapter 12. The sign that welcomed me to Tick Hill, New Hampshire, also informed me that the total population was 730 inhabitants. It was March 14th, 2011, a Monday. I had left Boston at just after 5 in the morning, and it was now 8:30. The village of Tick Hill was just north of the White Mountains. I'd done some research on the town and some on Norman Cheney, the man I was there to kill, but not too much. And what research I'd been able to do, I did at a library computer, jumping onto one of the desktops after a patron had left without logging off. I'd had my notebook with me and was able to take notes. What I learned about Tick Hill was that it had one diner and two bed and breakfasts, both popular because of their proximity to several ski areas. I pulled up a map and got an exact location for Norman Cheney on Community Road. The house, at least according to the map, looked fairly isolated. After sketching the location in my notebook, I began to research Norman Cheney, who had purchased the Tick Hill house 3 years earlier for $225,000. The only other possible hit I got on Norman Cheney was an obituary from 2007 for Margaret Cheney, a schoolteacher from Holyoke in western Massachusetts who had died in a house fire. Margaret Cheney, 47 years old when she died, had left behind two children, 22-year-old Finn and 19-year-old Darcy, and her husband of 23 years, Norman Cheney. It wasn't much, but it made me wonder. Could Norman Cheney have been responsible for the death of his own wife? And if so, was that why he'd been marked for death? And was that why he'd left Holyoke to live in a town of less than 1,000 residents? It had occurred to me that I didn't really need to kill Norman Cheney. If Duckburg, the site where I'd arranged the murder swap, was as anonymous as it promised, then there was no way that the stranger I'd communicated with would ever find out who I was. Well, that wasn't entirely true. Even if this stranger, this shadow version of myself, knew nothing about me, he did know one thing. He knew that I wanted Eric Atwell to die. That might put me on a long list, but it also might not. I had decided to go through with my half of the bargain. It seemed the safest thing to do, but also maybe the right thing to do in a twisted way. Before shutting down the library computer, I quickly looked up both Finn Cheney and Darcy Cheney. Unlike their father, they each had online presences. If I'd found the right people, then Finn Cheney was currently working at a small bank in Pittsfield, where he was also a trivia host at a local pub. Darcy Cheney now lived outside of Boston, attending graduate school at Lesley University in Cambridge. There were pictures of them both, and they were undoubtedly brother and sister. Jet black hair, heavy eyebrows, blue eyes, small mouths. Neither of them seemed to live with their father, and that was the most important piece of information that I got. If Norman Cheney lived alone, then my job became substantially easier. It had just begun to snow as I entered Tick Hill, light flakes that filled the air without seeming to land. I found Community Road, a sparsely populated and poorly paved road that wound up a hill. I slowed down as I approached number 42. The mailbox, painted black with white letters, was the only indication that a property even existed. Driving slowly by, I peered down the dirt driveway but couldn't make out the house in the woods. At the end of Community Road, I U-turned, then made a decision. This time I turned down the driveway. It twisted to the left, and then I could see the house. It was an A-frame construction, more windows than wood, made to look like a miniature ski chalet. I was very happy to see that there was no garage, and that only one vehicle, some kind of SUV, was parked out front. The chances that Norman Cheney was alone just went up significantly. Wearing gloves and with a balaclava on my head, but not pulled all the way down over my face, I stepped out of the car, holding a crowbar down near my leg. I approached the house, stepping up the two steps to the front door. It was solid wood, but there was a strip of beveled glass on either side. After ringing the doorbell, I peered into the dark interior of the house, made wonky by the ripple effect of the glass. I decided that if anyone other than a middle-aged man came toward the door, I would pull down my balaclava and make my way back to the car. I'd already smeared enough mud on the license plate so that both the number and the state were obscured. No one answered the door. I rang the bell again, a four-note chime, then saw a large, heavy-set man lumbering slowly down the stairs. Even through the glass, I could see he was wearing gray sweatpants and a flannel shirt. His face was ruddy, and his thick, dark hair was sticking up in tufts as though it was unwashed. The man pulled the door open. There was no fear in his expression, not even any hesitation.
Uh-huh.